Hi, this is Nicole Hensoth, editor of HPC Wire, here with today's edition of Soundbite, our daily interview series featuring researchers, thought leaders, and newsmakers in the world of high-performance computing. On today's edition of Soundbite, we'll start with a quick fact. From 2000 to 2010, about 1,900 cyclones churned across the top of the world each year, leaving warm water and air in their wake, and melting sea ice in the Arctic Ocean. Here to talk with us about these Arctic cyclones, how they're studied, and what they mean for climate research is Dr. David Bromwich, a professor of geography at The Ohio State University and senior research scientist at the Byrd Polar Research Center. Hi, Dr. Bromwich.
Hello there. Good to chat with you.
You too. Can you give us an overview of what it is you study and why these Arctic cyclones are important?
Yes. So first of all, I'd like to talk about the data set that was studied to produce these cyclones, to produce the characteristics of these cyclones. And it's based on something called the Arctic System Reanalysis. So this is a data generation exercise that focuses on the latitudes from roughly Columbus, Ohio, which is at 40 degrees north, all the way to the North Pole. And this data generation exercise, it's called a reanalysis, so one goes back and synthesizes a wide variety of observations, especially of the atmosphere. So we're talking about things like aircraft observations, wide-body aircraft that collect temperature, winds, and so on as they fly along. Radiosonde balloons, which are these little radio transmitters that get released. Tons of satellite observations. So there's a huge variety of observations available, particularly from the land areas of the Northern Hemisphere. And our particular effort called the Arctic System Reanalysis was to put all this together in a gridded form. So we know what the temperature, pressure, wind, clouds, precipitation, radiation from the atmosphere looks like. And our time period was from the year 2000 to today. And the data set that my Russian colleagues investigated was from 2000 to 2010. So just the early part of the new millennium. So let me talk a little bit about the computational aspects here. So the way we have to do it is we use a model of the atmosphere. So this is like the weather forecast models whose output you see on the TV weather forecast. And we run these on a grid, so lots of grid points in the horizontal. Our domain was roughly a square, and it covered about 10,000 kilometers on a side. So, and we had grid points every 30 kilometers. So that's a lot of grid points. And then we've got 70 levels in the vertical. So we have a huge number of grid points to consider. And we do this every 3 hours. So we run our model for a 3 hour forecast. And then we take all this diverse information sources and blend them together with what the model is doing. And that produces an analysis. So the winds, temperatures, moisture content, clouds, precipitation, and so on. And for each 3 hour segment, so every 3 hours, 365 days a year for 13 years, we're doing it right now. And this really takes a lot of computational resources. So when we're really doing this, it's not unusual for us to be running 3,000 cores of the Oakley cluster here at the Ohio Supercomputer Center. And we're specialists in producing vast amount of output. So we specialize in hundreds of terabytes from all these grid points and all these variables. So that's the background to this study. Would you like me to talk in detail about what the colleagues from Russia and myself did to look at the cyclones impacting the northern areas of our planet.
I would very much like us to move in that direction, but I do have a question first.
Yes.
What tools do you use, and what complexity is involved with synthesizing all of those diverse data points?
Okay, so it is a complex set of steps that are involved. First of all, there's the numerical weather model that is used to project forward for 3 hours in 3 hour time steps. And that is literally tens of thousands of lines of code, often written in Fortran, which I know is not a popular programming language with many people, but it has a long history in the scientific community. And codes like this are generated over the decades, actually. So there's that aspect. And then there's the blending, it's called data assimilation, between what the model projections are for that any 3 hour period and the observations that are available around that time. And I think I summarized what some of those were previously. Some of those observations are direct measurements of what goes on in the atmosphere, winds, temperature, moisture. Others are indirect. Those typically are from satellites, and they have to be translated into wind, temperature, and so on. So part of this blending exercise is to do that translation, the merging with the model fields, and one also in doing this considers the uncertainty, or the error bars if you want to think of it that way, of both the model projection and the observations themselves. So each individual type of observation has different error characteristics.
And what are the finalized data set sizes that you're often working with here?
Well, with our large number of grid points in the horizontal and 70 levels in the vertical and output every 3 hours for about 13 years, we have hundreds of terabytes of output.
Yeah. And you mentioned you're running these on the Oakley supercomputer there at OSC?
Yes, we are running on Oakley. And as I said, when we're really not just doing testing or fixing problems, but when we're doing production mode, we typically, there's 8,000 cores on Oakley, and if we could get every core that's available on that supercomputer, we'd use it.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the computational tools you might like to use in the future for an application like this? Is it just a matter of maybe throwing more cores at the problem, GPU acceleration, maybe eventually the MIC architecture? Is there anything on the horizon that strikes you as particularly beneficial here?
Well, faster computers are always desirable. The reason for that is that the spacing between the grid points, you always want to reduce those. So if you have more CPU cycles, you can do that. There's a nice little sum that one can do that, let's say your grid points are 30 kilometers apart. So one grid point every 30 kilometers, and you want to go to a spacing of 15 kilometers between grid points, you've got to do 8 times more calculations. So you basically, to, you know, increase the, halve the spatial resolution or double the number of grid points, you've got to do almost an order of magnitude more calculations. Mm-hmm. So easily, as big a computer as you have, it's not big enough for what I ideally might like to have.
Right. Keep generating more data the more work you do. So
yes.
It's a constantly evolving need there, I imagine.
Yes.
Right. So we were going to talk about the Russian researchers you're working with and what they've contributed to the project and what their end goal is for climate research.
Yes. Okay. So I just talked about the generation of this data set. And we call it once again for reference the Arctic System Reanalysis. So it's a retrospective look at what the atmosphere was doing for the last decade approximately. So what they did was they took one output from this reanalysis, which is what the pressure, the atmospheric pressure, is doing down at the ground. And they use what are called algorithms that find storm systems, areas of low atmospheric pressure. And they went through the entire reanalysis and were tracking, using this automated procedure that they have, the formation, propagation, and dissipation of storm systems, or another name is cyclones, that we see a lot here in the mid-latitudes and in most parts of the world. And they were looking at how many cyclones were impacting the area covered by this reanalysis, so roughly from 40 degrees north to the North Pole. So that's what they were studying. And they found many more cyclones in our reanalysis than people had realized or found previously. One of the so we're almost certain we know the reason for this. One is the fact we've got significantly higher spatial resolution, so we've got more grid points in the horizontal than previous efforts have had. This kind of been global reanalyses done. And the other thing is we're using almost all of the available observations, so much more than have been used previously. So what this allows one to do is basically to find all of these smaller scale cyclones. So that's one thing that our reanalysis does. And secondly, with the really big cyclones that have the big impact on people and everything, they can be found earlier in our reanalysis, and you can find that they actually live longer than other analyses suggest they do.
And what are some of those human impacts of these cyclones, by the way?
Okay. Well, I'd like to talk about the year 2012. So that was in August 2012. So it wasn't this past summer in the Arctic, but the summer before that. And that was the all-time low for the summer sea ice cover in the Arctic Ocean in that particular late summer. And the reason, one of the big reasons, I can't say it was the only reason, but one of the big reasons was this huge cyclone that impacted the Arctic Ocean. So this is the kind of system that shows up in our reanalysis. And what that did was it was very intense for that time of year, so the winds were very strong. It broke up the sea ice. It also mixed up the ocean, so it mixed it vertically. And sitting down, not too far down in the Arctic Ocean, is quite warm water. So if you bring the warm water up to the surface due to the stirring with the strong winds, then that'll also melt off the sea ice. So you break up the sea ice and you melt it as well. And that was a significant contributor to the big retreat of the sea ice happening that took place once again in it. The all-time minimum happened actually in September, so about a month later than the big cyclone was there, but the big cyclone kind of kicked it off is the way to think about it. Another one of the human impacts that is being particularly felt in the Arctic is because the sea ice is going away, so there's still sea ice covering the Arctic Ocean in September, but it's a lot less than it used to be. So we've got big areas of open water where we used to have sea ice cover. And what happens with any time you have a big storm over open water, you get huge waves, you know, wind-generated waves. We see them everywhere on our Earth. And they tend, in the areas that are close to the coast, particularly where you've got permafrost, they undermine the permafrost quite effectively. So the big waves crash into the shoreline, which is composed of permafrost, and basically degrade it. So in many of the areas, particularly happening in Alaska and also Siberia, that the coastline is retreating rather rapidly due to these big storms that are coming along in the fall, and some of the native villages actually in those areas that are close to the coast have had to be evacuated. They've moved them to higher ground farther away from the coast. So this is a very definite illustration of climate change in action up there.
Wow. So the future impacts of this research, can you give us a sense of what changes it might bring about as we understand more about these cyclones?
Yes. Well, I think we're all trying to understand why the climate is changing so rapidly in the north. It really, there's dramatic changes every year now up there. And one of the things we want to understand is the relative contribution of human-induced climate change and natural variability, you know, things that would have happened without the influence of people. And if we can separate those two and you use things like this Arctic system reanalysis to understand that, then we can project forward in time into the future with more confidence. So we'll know what the human impact, the direct human impact signature is likely to be. So how many more storms, how extreme they're going to be, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, this is very important research. We very much appreciate you taking time to put this in context in terms of how supercomputers are helping to move climate research forward, and I appreciate your time. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.